Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 12. I'm going to call this chapter The Kingdom Divides as we see the civil war that splits northern Israel from southern Judah. Our context is this. In the last chapter, we took a look at Solomon's wives, his 1,000 wives and concubines, his adversaries, his political enemies, his foreign enemies, and his death as he dies. So we start now in 1 Kings 12, verses 1 through 4. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon. He returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." Now, Rehoboam, of course, is the only son, probably the only son of Solomon, as Clark points out. It's interesting. He had 1,000 wives and one son. You would maybe spread himself too thin. And Adam Clark makes this comment. He says that even though Solomon was the wisest of men himself, his son was a poor, unprincipled fool. And we'll see that as we go through. I think that's a fair assessment of Rehoboam's character. But Clark says that Solomon was the wisest of men. I don't think so. I think he was a fool, too. He was too smart for his own good. Too many wives, too much idolatry, too many idols. Now, Rehoboam was 41 at the time of the rebellion that we're going to just find out about. This is Rehoboam versus Jeroboam. We know that because of 1 Kings 14:21. Now, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem. All right, so we got Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. Now, who's this Jeroboam that he's fighting? Jeroboam, if you recall from the last chapter, he did a good job working on the millo, the fortifications, the terraces in the northern end of the city of David, Mount Zion. Solomon thought he did a good job, and so he appointed him over the labor force of the entire house of Joseph. That's Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph. So those two tribes. So Jeroboam was coming up in the world, but then, remember, Ahijah the Shilonite, the prophet, met Jeroboam on the road. Ahijah tore his own new cloak into 12 pieces, and he gave 10 of them to Jeroboam and said, these 10 pieces represent the 10 tribes that you're going to get. I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand. So Jeroboam is thinking, hot dog, I'm going to be the king. Unfortunately, Solomon, having probably heard about it in some fashion, tried to kill Jeroboam. And so Jeroboam had fled to Egypt. So back here in chapter 12, in the parenthetical remark in verse 1, Jeroboam was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon, because Solomon was trying to kill him because of Ahijah's prophecy. So Jeroboam comes back from Egypt and goes to Shechem, not Jerusalem, Shechem. Now Shechem is a very interesting place. It's one of the most famous cities in the scriptures. So let me read you about Shechem. This is from Easton's Dictionary. It's a city in Samaria. It's also called Sichem. It stood in the narrow, sheltered valley between Ebal on the north, that's Mount Ebal on the north, and Mount Gerizim on the south, those mountains at their base being only 500 yards apart. And those were the two mountains, of course, from which the blessings and cursings were read. The blessings from Mount Gerizim on the south, the cursings from Mount Ebal on the north, Deuteronomy 28 and 29. Here Abraham pitched his tent. That's a lot 400 years before this, before the curses. Abraham pitched his tent and built his first altar in the promised land at Shechem. Received the first divine promise at Shechem, Genesis 12, 6. You know, about you're going to be the father of many nations, as numerous as the sand that covers the seashore. That was at Shechem. Here also Jacob bought a parcel of a field at the hands of the children of Hamor after his return from Mesopotamia. That's Abraham's grandson Jacob. Just got his wife Rachel and came back and bought a field there in Shechem. Settled with his household there. And then he purged from idolatry that place by burying the teraphim of his fathers under an oak tree, which was afterwards called the Oak of the Sorcerer. That's in Genesis 33. We talked about that already. After a while, they dug a well there, which bears his name to this day, Jacob's Well. To Shechem, Joshua, remember the woman at the well in dealing with Jesus in John chapter 4? She was from Sichem, which is Shechem, and she mentions the well there, Jacob's Well. To Shechem, Joshua gathered all Israel before God and delivered them his second parting address at Shechem. He made a covenant with the people that day at Shechem, at the very place where on first entering the land they had responded to the law from Ebal and Gerizim, which I just mentioned. Rehoboam was appointed king in Shechem, which is what we're talking about now. Jeroboam afterwards took up his residence here. We're going to look at that in just a minute in chapter 12 of this 1 Kings. The city is mentioned in connection with our Lord's conversation with the woman of Samaria. The famous Samaritan woman was there. It's one of the oldest cities in the world even today. So, very important place. Also, Easton says, the site of Shechem is said to be of unrivaled beauty, quoting somebody named Stanley. Stanley says it is the most beautiful, perhaps the only very beautiful spot in central Palestine. Now, in verse 1, it says all the Israelites had gone there to make Rehoboam king. Now, there are a couple of optional reasons as to why the Israelites went to Shechem instead of Jerusalem to make Rehoboam king. Here's what John Gill says. They say it was a pretense to go up to Shechem to make Rehoboam king. Actually, they went up there to make Jeroboam king because the people, the elders of the tribes, they knew of the prophecy of Ahijah. They knew that the kingdom was going to be taken away from Solomon, that there was going to be a split, and so they would go to Shechem, not Jerusalem, because Shechem is a city in the tribe of Ephraim where Jeroboam was, and they figured, well, that's a logical place to have a capital up there at Shechem because Jeroboam's going to be the new king, and that's where he is. Besides, Jeroboam had been up there in the tribe of Ephraim in Shechem, probably sowing the seeds of sedition earlier before he got booted and sent down to Egypt. And the elders probably thought they could more freely speak what they had in their minds when they went up to Shechem, when they wanted to make Jeroboam king. And so they said, okay, Rehoboam, it's time to go up to Shechem. Well, we'll make you king. But they didn't really mean it, according to Gill's theory. And they wanted to go up there to make sure that Jeroboam would be safe and not be attacked by Rehoboam if Jeroboam came back to Jerusalem instead of Shechem. So the idea that Gill has here is that Rehoboam went to Shechem not by Rehoboam's choice, but because of necessity, he was forced to go. And to back that up, we notice in verse 3, it says, they sent for Jeroboam. The idea is the whole assembly, all the elders of Israel, sent for Jeroboam to be king. Well, that's Gill's theory. That's not a bad one, but there's other options here. It could be they wanted to make Rehoboam king, but they wanted to attach conditions to his monarchy. Ellicott, the commentator, says this, Rehoboam seems to succeed without question to the throne of Judah, but to need to be made king by the rest of Israel, with apparently some right on their part to require conditions before acceptance. So in other words, whoever's right here, Gill or Ellicott, the coronation of Rehoboam was not in Jerusalem because the northern 10 tribes were ticked off at Solomon's rule, and Rehoboam was Solomon's son, and they didn't want to be down in Jerusalem where Rehoboam would have more clout and more power. So they were up in Shechem. Now in verse 4, we see what the northern 10 tribes' complaint was. It actually says in verse 3, the whole assembly of Israel, and is Israel the northern 10 tribes, or is that Israel and Judah? That's always a little bit ambiguous, but I'm assuming it's the 10 tribes said this. The tribes that were not directly descended from Solomon, descended from David, descended from Judah. Judah and Benjamin were in the south, the two tribes that were allied in the south, and this is probably the 10 northern tribes, and they say to Rehoboam, look, your father, that's Solomon, put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. Well, did they have a right to complain about a heavy yoke? Here's the argument that says, yes, they did have a right to complain. Solomon did lay heavy taxes upon them, this argument says. Why? Well, Solomon needed to fund all of his buildings, the beautiful palace, the beautiful temple, not to mention the fact the maintenance of those two buildings, which I'm sure was extraordinarily expensive. He had to maintain his huge household. He had 1,000 wives plus their attendants. He had to keep a large number of horses and chariots, as we talked about in a previous chapter. He had to pay the salaries of all of his officers. He had to support this magnificent court with all the food. Yeah, he taxed them. Didn't God tell? Didn't Moses through God in the law? I don't have the verse in front of me, but that famous verse that says, yeah, you want a king? No, it wasn't Deuteronomy. I'm sorry, it was in Samuel. Samuel said, you want a king? Well, he's going to tax you to death. He's going to draft your people into the army. Going on with the idea that Solomon needed to lay heavy taxes on the people, this would especially be true in the latter part of his life for the support of his vast number of wives and of their idolatrous worship. Now, that happened near the end of his reign. And also near the end of his reigns, of course, there's a lot of military people rising up against Solomon. We went through that in the previous chapter. Hadad of Zobah, the Syrian kingdom, Rezon who was Hadad's father, if I recall, Solomon had to fight all these people. So yeah, he probably put a bunch of taxes on them. However, those who say that the followers of Jeroboam were bad people because they objected to Rehoboam, these commentators say that the followers of Jeroboam failed to note the benefits of Solomon's reign in return for all those taxes. Their nation had honor and grandeur. They had liberty. They had peace, plenty, and safety. All of Solomon's days, well, at least in the first part of the reign, they lived in peace. They might have lived in safety all of Solomon's days, and I'm sure they did, but Solomon had to fight for that peace and safety at the end of his reign as things started to deteriorate. Also, there was an abundance of riches brought upon the people. Silver was as common as the stones of the street. People didn't care about silver. They wanted gold. Silver's too common. Well, that's right. And, of course, the complainers didn't mention all that. They just mentioned the high taxes. We're going to see here that both sides, that neither side can claim perfect virtue in this civil division that's about to happen. Now, the adherents of Jeroboam, the thing that they could really most complain about, they take no notice of. They should have complained about all the idolatry that Solomon had set up among them. So, whether they had a right to complain or not, their rebellion was still sinful. They didn't care about Solomon's idolatry. In fact, they started idolatry themselves. Jeroboam ended up putting up golden calves in Dan and Bethel for the rebels, the northern Israelites, to worship. All right, so whether they had the right to complain or not, they rebelled. Not only high taxes were they probably complaining about, but they were also probably made slaves, too, to build all these wonderful monuments of Solomon. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, "At first it is supposed Solomon employed no Israelite in drudgery. Afterwards, when he forsook the God of compassion, he seems to have used them as slaves and to have revived the Egyptian bondage." Clark speculates that. Now, at first, Solomon did not make the Israelite slaves. 1 Kings 9:22, the first part of the verse. "But Solomon did not consign the Israelites to slavery," the text says. Well, that was at the beginning. At the end, he very well may have, as Clark speculates. It wouldn't surprise me. Solomon had other sources of revenue, but they were inadequate. He had the tribute of dependent states around him, Moab, Edom, Ammon, Zobah. He had presents of foreign princes, like, remember, Queen of Sheba gave him all kinds of stuff. Profits of his commercial enterprises, all the ships that he's sending out from Ezion Geber and sailing with Hiram of Tyre and all that. He had lots of money coming in, but despite that, he had to put high taxes on the people, and the people were not happy about it. It finally led to a division in the kingdom. So we now go to 1 Kings chapter 5, verses 5 through 11. "Rehoboam answered, 'Go away for 3 days and then come back to me,' he answered the representatives of Jeroboam. So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. 'How would you advise me to answer these people?' he asked. They replied, 'If today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants.'" Wise advice from the old heads. "But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. He asked them, 'What is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, "Lighten the yoke of your father. Lighten the yoke your father put on us."' The young men who had grown up with him replied, 'Tell these people who have said to you, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter." Tell them, tell these followers of Jeroboam, tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist.'" So Rehoboam is supposed to brag that his little finger is thicker than Solomon's waist. In other words, I'm a big shot. I'm a big guy. I'm strong. You don't tell me not to put taxes on you. Verse 11, the lousy advice from the young advisors continues to suggest what Solomon should say to the followers of Jeroboam. Say this, "My father, Solomon, laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." So in verse 5, Rehoboam says, "Give me 3 days. Come back to me. I need to think about this." Now, was this a wise move? John Gill says no. Here's what he says. "At first sight, this may seem a point of prudence in him to take time for deliberation and counsel in this affair. But in his case and circumstance, it was very imprudent, for he might easily see there was discontent among the people and a faction forming against him. And by taking time to himself, he gave them time to take their measures," gave his opponents, Jeroboam's followers, "time to take their measures and hasten and ripen them for a revolt. For by giving them such an answer, they might plainly perceive he was not inclined to give them satisfaction. It would have been the most advisable in him to have promised them at once that he would make them easy. In other words, Gill says that what Rehoboam should have said is, sure, guys, I'm going to lighten your taxes. Think about it. All the kings in medieval Europe, what do they do when they get crowned? They throw gold out to the people. They ride on their horse throwing out gold and silver coins to the people. A lot of times they, in the Roman Empire, they would lower taxes when a new emperor would take over, to make people like them. Not Rehoboam. However, Jameson Foster Brown says it was a prudent thing to wait 3 days. By waiting 3 days, it does show the followers of Jeroboam that Rehoboam's not sure about this. So I tend to side with Gill on that. I think he should have just said right off the bat, okay, we'll lighten your load. Well, I hate taxes anyway because I hate governments. They always squander the taxes, kill babies with the taxes, create inflation by taking the taxes and spending it on gosh knows what. But at any rate, some people say that it was not a matter of prudence or imprudence. It was a matter of necessity that Rehoboam needed to give time for all the advisors that were available to come up from Jerusalem to get to Shechem. That's the pulpit commentary suggests that. Now, the old heads, they were the ones that learned how to rule a kingdom. They learned statecraft under Solomon. They were smart. They knew what they were doing. Usually old people have more wisdom than young people. That's a fact of life. Now, these young men who said, keep taxing them, they were probably in their 40s. Rehoboam was 41, so they probably grew up with Rehoboam. Said they said in verse 8 they grew up with him, the young men who had grown up with Rehoboam. As John Gill says, they were, quote, the sons of nobles with whom he had his education and who were his companions from his youth upwards and who were now officers in his court and of his privy council, being his favorites. Adam Clark says this, quote, it was a custom in different countries to educate with the heir to the throne young noblemen of nearly the same age. This answered two great and important ends. It excited the prince to emulation, that he might, as far as possible, surpass in all manly exercises and in all acts of prudence and virtue those whom one day he was to surpass in the elevation and dignity of his station. And two, the different purpose of educating the king with the nobles, that he might acquire a correct knowledge of the disposition and views of those who were likely to be under him the highest officers of the state, and consequently know the better how to trust and employ them. Now Rehoboam is urged to tell the followers of Jeroboam that my father Solomon laid on you a heavy yoke. So that's an admission. He admits that Solomon taxed them heavily, either financially or made them slaves, taxed their labor, by making them slaves. Either way, he put on them a heavy yoke. John Gill says this, to the contrary, no instance of severity exercised on the people in general can be given during the whole reign of Solomon. No, you can't really prove that he was cruel or arbitrary, but he did tax them to death and perhaps, maybe, put them into forced labor. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for Solomon here. And besides, Solomon's son Rehoboam admitted that his father had put upon the people a heavy yoke. Admission from his own mouth. He said, my father whipped you with whips. I'm going to whip you with scorpions. That sounds like an admission. You got whipped. My father whipped you. Now, what does it mean to whip you with scorpions? I, Rehoboam, am going to outdo my father in whipping. He just whipped you with whips. I'm going to whip you with scorpions. Here's four options. The scorpions could be larger whips, which give acute pain like scorpions. Option number two, they could be rods with thorns in the rods. Option number three, they could be rods with iron prongs in the rods, or they could be knotty and pickled rods. They were called scorpions because the rods made an arched or crooked wound. So I don't think anybody really knows, but it sounds terrible. We go to 1 Kings 12, verses 12 through 17. 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam. As the king had said, come back to me in 3 days. The king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given him by the elders. He followed the advice of the young men and said, my father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. My father Solomon scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. So the king did not listen. Rehoboam did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilonite. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, O David. So the Israelites went home. But as for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. Predictable results. The people got mad and left after Rehoboam said, I'm going to tax you and treat you even worse than my father Solomon did. Now, this turn of events is said in verse 15 to be from the Lord. No matter what people plan and decide on earth, it's always providentially directed by God. We need to remember that. The events was from the Lord in order to fulfill the word the Lord has spoken to Jeroboam. What word was that? Well, that's in 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 30 and 31 in the last chapter. Then Ahijah, that's a prophet from Shiloh, Ahijah the Shilonite. Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he had on, tore it into 12 pieces, and said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord God of Israel says. I am about to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I will give you 10 tribes. And so God providentially worked all this dispute over taxes and slavery and such, forced labor. He worked that dispute out so that the prophecy would come to pass. So in verse 16, all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, and all Israel, there's all the northern 10 tribes, Jeroboam's people. So they answered, what share do we have in David? We're out of here. Now, why did Rehoboam refuse to listen to the northern Israelites? Here's a speculation from Jameson Fawcett and Brown. Rehoboam's weakness and inexperience in public affairs has given rise to the probable conjecture that, like many other princes in the East, he had been kept secluded in the harem till the period of his accession, his father being either afraid of his aspiring to the sovereignty, like the two sons of David, Adonijah and Solomon, or, which is more probable, afraid of prematurely exposing his imbecility. The king's haughty and violent answer to a people already filled with a spirit of discontent and exasperation indicated so great an incapacity to appreciate the gravity of the crisis, so utter a want of common sense, as to create a belief that he, Rehoboam, was struck with judicial blindness. In other words, God made him blind because nobody could be that stupid on their own. Rehoboam's words were received with mingled scorn and derision. The revolt was accomplished, and yet so quietly, that Rehoboam remained in Shechem, fancying himself the sovereign of a united kingdom, until his chief tax gatherer, who had been most imprudently sent to treat with the people, had been stoned to death. This opened his eyes, and he fled for security to Jerusalem. We'll see the details of the stoning of his tax collector in just a minute. Now in verse 16, when the followers of Jeroboam said, what share do we have with you, David? John Gill reproaches them for that. He says this, quote, great ingratitude when he, that's Solomon, had done such great things for them, or David. They said, what share do we have in your house, O David? Referring to the tribe that Rehoboam was from. And Gill says, oh, such great ingratitude when he had done, David had done such great things for them. And David and his son Solomon had raised them to the pitch of wealth and glory they now enjoyed. These were seditious expressions. Well, yeah, but does John Gill acknowledge the heavy taxes and the forced labor? I have a little bit of sympathy for the followers of Jeroboam. You tax me to death, there's going to be revolt. On my part, if I can do it. Of course, it was treason, it was sedition, and it was idolatrous because they set up golden calves, so they didn't come into this revolt with clean hands. But nonetheless, Solomon drove them to it, and Rehoboam especially drove them to it. Now, verse 17 presents a little problem, but as for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. Now, what that sounds like is that some members of the northern 10 tribes were scattered outside of the northern 10 tribe area, and they were scattered through Judah, and Rehoboam was king over them because they were down in Judah. Could be that. The Cambridge commentary takes it that way. And in taking it that way, you take the word Israelites as referring to all of Israel, all 12 tribes of Israel. Excuse me. You take it that way, you take the Israelites as referring to the 10 tribes of Israel, and then those Israelites from the north were scattered through the two tribes of the south, and Rehoboam was ruling over them. I think that's too complicated. I think that it's easier to take Israelites here as all Israelites, and then the distinction in the whole mass of Israelites is that some were living in the towns of Judah in the south, and Rehoboam's ruling over them, and that would be Judah and Benjamin in the south, and then Jeroboam was then left to rule over the Israelites living in the north. In that way, Israelites refers to all people of Israel, whether north or south. Of course, anytime you see Israelites, it's a question. Does it refer to northern Israel as opposed to Judah, or does it include Judah? We go down to 1 Kings 12, verses 18 through 24. King Rehoboam sent out Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor, but all Israel stoned him to death. Again, is that Israel, just the northern 10 tribes, or is that the northern 10 tribes plus Judah and Benjamin? I don't know, but I do know he got stoned to death. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escaped to Jerusalem. Left Shechem and went to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Now there, Israel in verse 19 is referring to the northern 10 tribes because it's in revolt against the house of David, which is the southern 2 tribes. House of David is Judah, and then Benjamin is allied with Judah. Verse 20, when all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Again, that's northern Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. When Rehoboam arrived in Jerusalem, he mustered the whole house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 fighting men, to make war against the house of Israel, that's the northern 10 tribes, and to regain the kingdom for Rehoboam, son of Solomon. But this word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God. Say to Rehoboam, son of Solomon, king of Judah, to the whole house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, this is what the Lord says. Do not go up to fight against your brothers, the Israelites. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing. So they obeyed the word of the Lord and went home again, as the Lord had ordered. Now this Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor, who sent out to collect some taxes and got stoned to death for his trouble, this is the same Adoniram that was in charge of forced labor during the time of David. 2 Samuel 20, verse 24, and Adoram, or Adoniram, was over the forced labor. Hebrew, it has Adoram, the Septuagint, and the Syrian has Adoniram, as the Holman Christian Study Bible note says, the same guy. And also, when David's son Solomon took over, Adoniram still in charge of the forced labor, 1 Kings 4, 6. Adoniram, the son of Abdo, was over the men subject to forced labor. John Gill says of this tax-collecting expedition that Adoniram went on, quote, says about Adoniram, quote, a very improper person. The heavy taxes were their complaint, and a tax gatherer, and especially one that was at the head of the tribute, must be of all men the most disagreeable to them. This is another instance of the folly and false steps of Rehoboam. Yeah, that was stupid. Just really stupid. Now, stoning somebody, there's no excuse for that. That's a tax revolt gone amok. Was an illegal act of murder and revolution. Again, the northern 10 tribes did not go into their secession and their revolt with clean hands. Well, Rehoboam hightails it out of Shechem. He's not so proud and mighty now. Who's he going to whip with scorpions now? They made a fool out of him. The northern 10 tribes did. So after he leaves, and then Jeroboam returns, verse 20, well, Jeroboam had already returned, but the Israelites hadn't heard of it. Verse 20, when all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, that means he had returned to Shechem from Egypt, as I previously said. John Gill says of this, the chief men knew of it before, for he had headed them in their approach and address to Rehoboam, but the people in common had not, and especially those of the various tribes besides that of Ephraim. So the discussion about the taxes, will you relieve us of our taxes, give me 3 days and all that, that was just done with the big shots. The average person didn't know. But now the word got out that Jeroboam had come back. Rehoboam had fled to Jerusalem. And now we've got a choice to make. Are we going to follow the revolt? Well, they did. They called an assembly, made Jeroboam king. And now we're at the brink of a civil war. So Rehoboam flees from Shechem to Jerusalem. That's about 40 miles away, not very far. Well, I guess it might be a little far considering how people traveled back then, but it's not a whole far away. It's not a great distance away. So in verse 21, if after he gets back down to Jerusalem, Rehoboam musters the whole house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. In other words, he's mobilizing for war. Now, some people say that that shows that Rehoboam has courage. It also shows that Judah and Benjamin were completely behind him because Rehoboam managed to raise so numerous an army so quickly. And as a matter of fact, Rehoboam probably would have won the war if there had been one. Why? Well, because Jeroboam was scarcely settled in his kingdom. He had just been proclaimed king, but that's a very shaky beginning. He wasn't an established king yet, and he hadn't raised any army yet. So Rehoboam very well could have won, but God sent a prophet, Shemaiah, and says, no, don't go up there and fight the northern Israelites. Don't go fight Jeroboam. Rehoboam take it easy, stand down. James and Fawcett Brown say, quote, this was great deference both in Rehoboam and his officers to relinquish at the demand of the prophet a war which they thought they had good grounds to undertake. Yeah, they probably would have won it. But Shemaiah says, hold off. Now, it's always interesting to me that leaders of states from which there has been a secession, those leaders of the seceded from state will always fight. Think about the American colonies leaving the British Empire. Why didn't the Brits just say, hey, you don't want to stay with us? Go away. Well, the answer is money, of course. The colonies represented a lot of goods, and under that mercantilist system, they were basically slaves, economic slaves of the Brits. And why would the British want to let them go? How about Abraham Lincoln, when the Southern states wanted to secede? He could have just said, well, bye-bye. Instead, he started a war by invading South Carolina, my home state. He invaded, and the war that followed cost something like 6 million lives, if I recall. It was a horrible disaster. Why did he just say go away? You don't want to stay with us? It's all about money. Southern states represented a lot of money, a lot of taxes, they didn't have income taxes back then, but it was a lot of business. You can count on it. And it wasn't over slavery, by the way, because Abraham Lincoln went to great pains until the Union victory at Antietam and the Emancipation Proclamation, he went to great pains to say, we're not fighting this war over slavery. We're fighting it over the Union, to preserve the Union, as he wrote to Horace Greeley in a New York newspaper in a famous letter. But at any rate, that's off the subject. My point is it's unusual for somebody like Rehoboam to say, okay, leave Jeroboam, we're not going to fight you. Saved a bloody civil war. So Rehoboam at least had that going for him, but he had to have a prophet from God to tell him that, because most of the time it doesn't happen. Now there's a strange expression here in verse 22. Shemaiah is speaking, he says this. Well, God says to Shemaiah, say to Rehoboam, say to the whole house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, don't fight. Who's the rest of the people? He's talking to Judah and Benjamin. That sounds like everybody down there. Well, here's some suggestions as who the rest of the people are. First option, it could be other tribes that might dwell among the Judahites and the Benjaminites at Jerusalem, especially Simeon. Remember, Simeon did not have any contiguous tribal territory. Simeon just had cities that were scattered all through Judah in the south. So that might have been who God is telling Shemaiah to talk to in addition to Judah and Benjamin. Or it could be scattered northern Israelites who were living in Judah. They were away from their home tribes. We've already mentioned that's a possible interpretation of 1 Kings 12:17. Rehoboam reigned over the Israelites living in the cities of Judah. If you take Israelites as referring to the northern 10 tribes, then they're scattered down there amongst the Judahites and the Benjaminites. And so God tells Shemaiah, well, tell those guys too, don't go up and fight your brothers up there in the north. I don't really hold to that. I think it's talking about Rehoboam ruled over the other Israelites, namely the Judahites and the Simeonites, who were of Israel, and they were the ones that he's ruling over. At any rate, everybody gets the word. Now notice God tells Shemaiah, this is what the Lord says, do not go up to fight against your brothers, the Israelites, the northern 10 tribes, your brothers. Nothing worse than a brother's war. That's what they said about the American war between the states. It was a brother's war, and it was horrible because brother was fighting brother. So that was one reason they weren't supposed to fight. It would be a civil war. The other reason is that they would be fighting against the Lord, because God had promised through Ahijah the Shilonite, the prophet, that 10 tribes were going to be taken away from Solomon's hand. Now God tells Shemaiah to tell the southern 2 tribes, look, this is my doing. In other words, this is God's doing. Adam Clark says concerning that, quote, they had neither legal nor constitutional right. Talking about the northern 10 tribes, had no legal or constitutional right. Jeroboam was not of the blood royal. He had no affinity to the kingdom. Nothing could justify this act of rebellion, but the just judgment of God. So that's why God said, this is my doing. God thus punished a disobedient and gainsaying people, and especially Solomon's family, whose sins against the Lord were of no ordinary magnitude. Horrible idolatry. So in other words, it was a rebellion, but Jeroboam, as I said before, he was not innocent in this affair, even though God let him get away with it. We go now to 1 Kings 12:25-30. Then Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. From there he went out and built up Peniel. Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. That's Rehoboam in the south. Judah, in other words, the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. After seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. Bad advice. He said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel and the other in Dan. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there, the one golden calf there. Why did Jeroboam fortify Shechem? Well, Shechem actually had been destroyed earlier. In Judges 9, we read this. We read about a story that Gil tells us about, quote, not that this city had lain in ruins from the time of Abimelech, Gideon's son, for then it would not have been a proper place for the convention of the people. But he repaired the walls of it, fortified it, and built a palace in it for his residence. Well, Gil doesn't think the whole city was just wiped out since the time of the judges when Abimelech got it wiped out. Let me read that. Judges 9:45. So Abimelech fought against the city that entire day, captured it, and killed the people who were in it. Then he tore down the city and sowed it with salt. So Gideon's son Abimelech wiped out Shechem. Gil speculates that the city had actually come back somewhat, because otherwise they wouldn't have had a meeting up there between Jeroboam's people and Rehoboam. Jameson Farson Brown, on the other hand, says the city was destroyed and rebuilt by Jeroboam. Well, I don't know. I think Gil's probably right. Fortified just means they made it stronger, shored up the walls, whatever. Also, Jeroboam built up Peniel. Now, Peniel is the place, it's a famous place, because that's the place where Jacob wrestled the angel of the Lord, probably Jesus, when he was coming back from getting Rachel from Laban in Aram in Syria. KnowTheWord.com says it was while Jacob was all alone at Peniel that the angel of the Lord, an Old Testament appearance of Christ, wrestled with him all night. We read about that in Genesis 32:30. Jacob then named the place Peniel. Jacob gave the name of the place Peniel. Peniel means he sees, I think. He named it Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, he said, and I have been delivered. And by the way, the NIV footnote says that the Hebrew here is Penuel, P-E-N-U-E-L, and that's a variant of Peniel, so we're not going to worry about that. Penuel, Peniel. Both are okay. Jameson Foster Brown says Peniel was a ruined city with a tower east of Jordan on the north bank of the Jabbok. It was an object of importance to restore this fortress as it lay on the caravan road from Gilead to Damascus and Palmyra. Gilead is the land east of the Jordan River. You go northeast in the middle of the desert there, the Syrian desert. You get to Palmyra, Big Tadmor it was called back then, Palmyra even today. It's a bunch of ruins today, but that's where it was. And then you keep going further northeast and you hit Damascus. So Peniel was on that trade route, and so that's why Jeroboam built up the city and secured his frontier there. John Gill says this, Peniel was, quote, a place on the other side of the Jordan, the tower of which was beaten down by Gideon and might now be rebuilt, or at least the city was repaired by him, by Jeroboam, and anew fortified, perhaps for the better security of his dominions on that side of the Jordan, which Jeroboam built. All right, so Jeroboam's trying to establish his kingdom. Then he's got another problem. He thinks, well, you got a temple down there in Jerusalem. The people are supposed to go down there for the three feasts every year. They're going to go down there, then they're going to start liking what they see. They're not going to like living up here with me as king, as their king, Jeroboam. And so they're going to swear allegiance to Rehoboam, and then I'm going to be toast. So he decides to make two golden calves to make it easier so they don't have to go down to Jerusalem. Jeroboam said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Well, that sounds like he really cares about them. But no, he was doing that for his political security, to keep the people from going down there. The people, quote, I don't know who said this, one of my commentators, the people, quote, being drawn by the magnificence of the temple, the beauty and order of worship in it, the holiness of the place and the grandeur of the royal court, and the persuasions of the priests and prophets of the Lord, both to keep to the service of the Lord and to obey their lawful sovereign. And besides, they might be in fear. They should be taken up and punished as traitors, and therefore would choose to submit to Rehoboam, that they might have the liberty of sacrificing without fear. Jeroboam seems conscious himself that Rehoboam was their liege lord and lawful king. There's a lot of soft power built into that temple. Lots of cultural heritage and religious heritage. And of course, that would hurt Jeroboam's rule in the north at Shechem. So he comes up with the idea of putting a golden calf in Dan, which is right at the northern edge of the kingdom, right north of Lake Hula, either near or coterminous with the old city of Laish. You recall the story of how Dan broke off from their main allotment of land and went up and started a branch of Dan way up there in the north. And then, of course, Bethel is at the very southern end of Ephraim, which is the southernmost province that Jeroboam was in charge of. So he put the calves at the northern and southern extreme of his kingdom of Israel. He was also, I'm sure, imitating Aaron. Remember, Aaron built a golden calf in the wilderness? That could be why, although it seems to me, why would you want to remind the Israelites of a horrible chapter in their history where all those people died because they worshiped the golden calf? Maybe the people had gotten so spiritually obtuse they couldn't remember that the golden calves were bad. It could be he was not really imitating Aaron, but he had been down in Egypt so long. Remember, he had fled to Egypt to keep Solomon from killing him. And while he was down there, he could have been influenced by Egypt's religion. Egypt had two golden calf gods, one of which they called Apis, who worshipped at Memphis, which is right south of present-day Cairo. And then the other golden calf was called Menevis, and that was worshipped at Heliopolis, which is right north of present-day Cairo. So Egypt was famous for having two golden calf gods. And maybe Jeroboam picked that up while he was down there. But at any rate, for whatever reason, he did it. Now, as I mentioned, Bethel was on the border of Ephraim and Benjamin, right there at the far southern edge of the northern 10-tribe nation of Israel. Now, he might have chosen Bethel not only because it's as far south as you could get to make it convenient for people down there, but also because of all the associations that went with Bethel. Bethel's a famous place. Remember Jacob's ladder, Jacob's ziggurat, angels ascending and descending to God, just like the Babylonian ziggurat, the step, the ladder-looking structure where people thought they could climb up to God. But Jacob sees angels going up and down. He didn't climb up the steps. The angels did, because that's how he communicated with God, because God opened it up for him. So Bethel's sort of a famous place. God is, as a matter of fact, if you recall the story from the patriarchs in Genesis, God visited Jacob there more than once. So that's a good reason to put it there. Now, as far as Dan in the far north, Dan had idols placed there before. If you recall from Judges chapter 17, the story of Micah and his teraphim, a man named Micah had stolen 1,100 silver shekels from his mother. His mother cursed him for it. He says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Mama." He returned the silver. The mother said, "Oh, I got my silver back, so let's make an idol." She made an idol, and the silversmith carved the idol, placed it in a shrine in Micah's house, and the idol was called Teraphim. And then some scouts from Dan stole the Teraphim, went up north to Dan, or Laish, Dan, and installed the Teraphim up there. So there's idolatry there from before. Jeroboam's going to finish the job. We go now to 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 31 through 33, and we'll be finished with this chapter. Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. This he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made, and at Bethel he also installed priests at the high places he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, not God's, he offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel. So he instituted the festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. Now in verse 31, Jeroboam appoints priests even though they were not Levites. Remember, and of course the Levites he's talking about there is really the special people from the tribe of Levi, namely those from the family of Aaron, who they were the only ones that could be priests. The other three families, the Kohathites, the Merarites, and the Gershonites, they couldn't be priests. But if you were from the family of Aaron, you could be. But Jeroboam just appointed priests from all sorts of people, not from the tribe of Levi, but from the tribe of Dan, Naphtali, Asher, Zebulun, didn't matter. So you see, this is illegal worship, degrading God's holy commands in the book of Leviticus and the law, in the book of Exodus. All sorts of people were being priest. Now the KJV has the lowest of the people John Gill says that's a bad translation. It's not talking about the low quality of people that were priests. Priests would only come from a high class of people. Otherwise, these priests would have been very unpopular. In fact, Jeroboam himself served as a priest. In that verse I just read, it said, he instituted for the festival and went up to the altar to make offerings. So he was being an illegal priest, merging the office of priest and king. We also read in the next chapter, verse 1, chapter 13, a man of God came from Judah to Bethel by a revelation from the Lord while Jeroboam was standing beside the altar to burn incense. So Jeroboam's acting like a priest. I think this is obvious, but Adam Clark disagrees. He says the King James translation is okay, the lowest of people. Those whom he took seemed to have been worthless, good-for-nothing fellows who had neither piety nor good sense. I think Clark is wrong there. Just means all sorts of people from every tribe. Now, pointing people who were not from the tribe of Aaron, not Levites, in other words, not from the tribe of Levi, namely Aaronites, why would that be an advantage to Jeroboam? Well, first of all, it would enrich himself because he would take the cities that belonged to the priests and the Levites. Remember, they were assigned cities scattered through all the tribes. The Levites were also. Well, Jeroboam got them. How do we know that? Because the Levites were obliged to leave their homes because Jeroboam drove them out. We see that in 2 Chronicles 11:14. For the Levites left their pasture lands and their property and came to Judah and Jerusalem. For Jeroboam and his sons had excluded them from serving as priests to the Lord. So they all fled south to work under Rehoboam. So Jeroboam stole Levite property by running the priest out and letting other tribes perform the priesthood. That's the first advantage he got. The second advantage is that Jeroboam pleased the people because he laid open the priesthood to them. Remember, people had to pay tithes to the priests and the Levites to support them. Well, now they don't have to anymore. Although it doesn't state that Jeroboam did away with the tithes, but if the tithes were paid to the Levites and the Levites are gone, I suspect the people would say, hey, we don't have to pay tithes anymore. But if they did have to pay tithes, then some of the people from the northern ten tribes could say, well, I'm going to be a priest so I can collect those tithes. Either way, money was taken from the Levite tribe and left at the disposal of Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam in verse 32 started a feast on the 8th month. The Feast of Tabernacles was on the 7th month, the 15th day. So Jeroboam just waited a month, says, well, we'll do ours the next month so as we won't get it confused, I suspect, with the 7th month. So the 8th month was Markesvan, if I can say it right. It's October, November of our calendar. Bull was the Canaanite name of that month. Markesvan was the Babylonian name. Gill says of this, quote, the fruits of the land were not so soon ripe nor so soon gathered in the northern parts of the land as near Jerusalem. He judged this month the fittest for the feast of ingathering the fruits, and he might hope to get more people to come to his feast when all were gathered in. The Feast of Tabernacles was a harvest festival, and the harvest in the south, according to Gill, was done sooner in September, October, in Tishri, but the crops came in later in the north. And so Jeroboam, according to Gill, postponed his harvest festival until the next month, the 8th month, Markesvan, instead of the 7th month, Tishri. In verse 33, as I said earlier, Jeroboam went up to the altar to make offerings. Only priests were supposed to do that. Remember, Uzziah got leprosy for doing that, the later king. Why didn't Jeroboam get leprosy? Well, as John Gill says, this was not a true altar of the Lord. The whole thing was idolatrous. The whole thing was bad. I mean, they all should have been struck dead, but they weren't messing with God's holy altar. This was an idolatrous altar, and so the rules didn't apply there. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with 1 Kings chapter 12. We are now ready to go in our next audio to 1 Kings chapter 13. In that chapter, we will see a man of God confronting Jeroboam. Interesting story. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.